gives me a lot of pleasure for a man to get up here that needs no introduction to anyone that's been around any length of time. Your friend and my friend, Chuck C.
Thank you. I'm Chuck Steele, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. That's my talk, and my wife just took it away from me. You know, Miss C and I were in Midland, Texas on the 24th of January. And we'd sat along on Sunday night to talk with friends down there. One gentleman in particular who had gotten sober was Roy Y. in Houston. Back in the very early days, and we talked much of Bill and Lois and Dr. Bob and the rest. And we were late getting home, and so we were sleeping in a little the next morning, and the phone rang. And it was this gentleman with whom we'd been talking the night before, and he informed us that Bill had left that night, 11 o'clock, Sunday night on January 24th. And although I knew that it was imminent, I reacted, I guess, a little bit. And he immediately consoled me by telling me, you know, and I know, that Bill has just gone into another room. And of course, this is something that our people know. Just seems like all of them know this. That there is no finality or validity in death. That we just go into another room. Not very long after we had gotten the first notification, we also got a call from New York, and one of the ex-trustees from Canada and one of the present trustees had called us to tell us the sad news. Now, it's funny, but the thing that hit me immediately and has kept hitting me from then until now was thank God that we had him as long as we did. Thank God that Bill was with us as long as he was. 36 years. We had Bill. He got sober in the fall of 1934. Again, it's rather interesting to me that they celebrated Bill's birthday in October. I guess through all these years, they've celebrated his birthday in October. And some years back, we were visiting together, and he told me, he says, you know, we just might be celebrating my birthday before it was. He says, recently, they've been telling me that I was still in the hospital on Thanksgiving Day. So, maybe he didn't get sober in October. Maybe it was November.
But that makes very little difference. And I think in my little time, I want to talk a little bit about that which God hath wrought through Bill and the rest of them. And then to talk a little about my own association with him. You know, we've already been told, and you all know it anyway, that prior to 1934, 1935, when people got to the end of the line, as you and I did, there was no place for them to go. They just went ahead and died. And so, in the fall of 1934, a chap by the name of Ebby had called on Bill, and Bill thought it was going to be a good excuse for some drinking. Laid in a little bigger supply of gin than usual, and was ready for Ebby when he came. And Ebby came, and he was well-dressed, looked good, and he was sober. And Ebby talked to Bill about what had happened to him. He'd seemingly gotten connected with a group called the Oxford Group, and he'd found a way to obtain and maintain sobriety, and told him a little about it, about their confessions one to another, talking out their problems, and finding a power greater than themselves, and making restitution and that sort of thing. And he lost Bill when he talked about a power greater than himself, because Bill in those days thought he was an agnostic. And so Ebby talked a while and left. And it wasn't too long after that until Bill had gotten done in again and had to go back to town hospital. And while he's there, he heard Dr. Silkworth, one of our beloved medical friends, telling Lois, Bill's wife, that there was nothing that could be done for Bill, that he was hopeless, that he might have as much as 6 months to live, and the kindest thing that she could do with him or for him would be just to make it as easy for him as he could before he left. Well, now, Bill didn't feel very good before he heard that. He was suffering from the effects of that flit. And when he heard that, it was sort of the seal of doom. And so he thought to himself about Ebby's talk with him and about the mention of a power greater than himself. And he thought it wouldn't be too bad to at least give it a chance. And so, in total and complete surrender, he cried out, "O God, if there be a God, reveal yourself to me now." And there was an instant reaction. Bill never got very serious about this. He called it, up until the time he left, I guess, his hot flash. But what happened, the room was filled with light. And there was a great peace upon him. His body was as if it weren't. No substance, no weight. Seemed that the breezes could blow through him. And it was quite a transcendent spiritual experience. Enough so that it shook him to his toes. And when Dr. Silkworth came back to the room, he told him about it. And he said to the doctor, "Have I gone completely nuts?" And the doctor says, "If you have, you better keep it." He says, "You're making more sense than you've ever made." And so, before Bill even left the hospital, he started to carry the message to the other alcoholics who were in town hospital at that time. When he got out, he continued to work with alcoholics, getting them wherever he could, pulling them off the bar stools, going down to the Bowery and getting them and taking them home with him. And in the next 6 months, he worked with some 75 alcoholics. And he thought that none of them had responded. He thought the whole thing was fruitless. However, he had stayed sober. But, lest I forget it, out of that 75, in later years, 62 of them were located in groups around the Eastern Seaboard. So the percentage held true, even with the 75 that they thought they'd failed with. And so 6 months went by, and Bill had made a little bit of a recovery, and the people in the stock market on Wall Street had learned that he was sober, and they gave him a little job to do down in Akron, Ohio. And he went down there to do it, to get some proxies in a company. And when he got down there, he found that somebody had already been there and they had already gotten the proxies. And his business trip was of no avail. And he went back to the hotel, and it was a Sunday, as I remembered. And he was very, very disappointed, very upset because his business deal had failed. And he was walking the lobby. At one end of the lobby, there was a directory of churches. And at the other end, there was a cocktail bar. And the music was playing, and the laughter was coming out of there. And there was a great pull for Bill to go in and get a drink. And he found it very necessary to see if he couldn't get a hold of another alcoholic to talk with. Not to save him, but to save himself. And so he got a handful of nickels and started calling the preachers that were listed on this church directory. And eventually, when he was about out of nickels and out of preachers, he got a hold of a fellow that put him in touch with a non-alcoholic lady by the name of Henrietta Seiberling, the Seiberling Tire people. And Henrietta arranged for him to meet Dr. Bob, a doctor in Akron who had lost his way completely with the booze. And a meeting was arranged, and Bill used a new technique this time. Because just before he had gone down to Akron, he had had another talk with our beloved Dr. Silkworth. And Dr. Silkworth had said, "Bill, maybe you have the cart before the horse. Maybe instead of trying to sell your spiritual experience, that you should first talk of the physical part of the disease of alcoholism. Identify with these new people physically first. And when you get them softened up, having explained to them the serious nature of the disease of alcoholism, then you can tell them about the spiritual experience, and maybe you can do some good with it." And this, for the first time, he used on Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob became the second member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And together, they went to the hospital and talked with an attorney who was strapped down in the psycho ward. and his name was Bill Dee, and he became the third member. And Bill stayed with Dr. Bob several months, and the first group of Alcoholics Anonymous came into being in Akron. Shortly thereafter, Bill went back to New York, and they got a group started back in New York. And when it was found that they had a program that would work, they decided that maybe they ought to have a book. And the fur started to fly. We drunks don't want change. We never want change, you know. And so the drunks of that day says, you know, we got along up until now without a book. What do we need with a book? And so the big ball started. But they decided they had to have a book, and it wasn't entirely an honest decision there either. Because the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous were pretty much promoters. Now, I don't know why I would say the early members. Looking at you people. But they were pretty much a promoting lot. And they were going to write this book, and they were going to make a lot of money out of it. Along with giving the doctors and the drunks something to read, you know. And so, they sold a bunch of stock to the drunks. $25 here and $25 there to help finance the book. And they wrote it. Many people had a little hand in that. People, men of the cloth, and men of medicine, men of psychiatry, all did a great job of reading the manuscripts and talking to Bill and the rest of them who were working on the deal. And so they wrote the book. 1949, I think, 1939, they came out of the book. They got 10,000 of them, expecting to make a killing right at first, and I think they sold three. The book business went to hell before it started. They had an awful time even keeping the copies that they had. But they were working, you know, they're working their heads. And as always, some of the gang there in New York knew some pretty influential people. Amongst them, John D. Rockefeller. And they had dreamed up, when they found that they had a program that would work, that they should have a string of hospitals all over the world to take care of the drunks. They were going to sober everybody up, you know. And they were going to need a string of hospitals. And therefore, they were going to need a lot of money. And, of course, these first drunks were going to be the head men. They were going to run all this deal. And so they had to get some money, so they got to John D., and he set up a dinner in New York with all the money in New York at the dinner. And a few of these drunks told their story. And the rest of them were spotted around the audience looking, you know, to see how they were doing. And, of course, they were doing well. Because these stories were quite heartrending. And the money people were taking it big. And they figured that they had them. They were off and running. They were going to get all the money they needed. Because there was much money represented in that dinner in New York. And about the time they thought they had everything nailed down, John D.'s secretary got up and read a little note from him, and he said that he'd been most impressed by this budding Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. That probably nothing in many years had impressed him as much as this group of alcoholics who were finding an answer to their problem. And he said, the wonder of it is that they don't need any money. It's just one alcoholic talking to another. Money would ruin them, said John D. Rockefeller. Whereupon all the dough got up and went home. And they had a very difficult struggle there for a while. I'm not going to spend too much time on it because I haven't that much time. I'd love to talk to you till midnight about this man and about what he did. But we don't have that much time. So we'll hurry along. It wasn't long until Jack Alexander was commissioned by the Post, Saturday Evening Post, to expose this deal. It was thought that the drunks had enough trouble and they shouldn't be exploited, and that this deal was was nothing moral but a way to exploit drunks. And so he came down to investigate. And it took a lot of selling. They took Jack to meetings all over the place and talked with him by the hour. And whilst he came down to expose them, he remained to pray with them. And his article came out in the Post March 1941. And that was really the start of the big influx of people into Alcoholics Anonymous. Not far from that time, perhaps just a little before, the Cleveland Plain Dealer had run a series of articles in the center of the editorial page of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, I believe they called it. And they had a tremendous influx of people in Cleveland. And Clarence S., who now lives in Florida, and his wife Dorothy, were in the middle of that deal and got it going in Cleveland. So Alcoholics Anonymous started to grow. And Art has told you that presently we have some 400,000, 475,000, I believe they said in the information, in 16,000 groups spread over the world in 90 some odd different countries. Our literature has been translated into many languages. And much is going on outside of the continental limits of the Americas in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been most fortunate throughout our time that many non-alcoholics of great stature have been a part of our society, not as alcoholics, but as friends of Alcoholics Anonymous. A few of them were Dr. Silkworth, Dr. Harry Thiebaud, Father Ed Dowling, a non-alcoholic Jesuit priest. Dr. Sam Shoemaker. Bernie Smith. God rest his soul. Bernie served this society for over 30 years. He was a non-alcoholic. And a great, great man. One of the best. And just to digress 1 second, when I went back to New York as your delegate for the first time, Bernie Smith got out of a sick bed in Scotland and flew to New York to spend the time with us, and then flew back to Scotland to go back to bed and be sick a while longer. Now, he was a non-alcoholic. You know, if Bill had been over there, we'd have expected him to swim the Atlantic if it was necessary. But for a non-alcoholic to love this society that much, it made an everlasting impression on me. And he was a great, great help to Bill in working out the many things that had to be worked out over the years. Now, a few of those things I want to mention. I didn't mention, of course, Sister Ignatius and a few of the rest of them that were so vital to us in the early days. But the 12 traditions would not be anything at all to cause controversy. They caused much controversy. Because, like the book, they hadn't had any 12 traditions. And they didn't want it. And there was no law. The 12 traditions, they came out, they were printed first in 1946. And they were accepted by a society in 1950 at the first international convention in Cleveland, Ohio. Now, in explaining these traditions to Mrs. C and I in our home, Bill's explanation was almost entirely personal. Were there almost mainly because of his own defects of character, his own power drives, his own, what he called a tremendous ego. And so he needed the 12 traditions as well as the society needing the 12 traditions. And we need them today. Probably more than any other time, we need the 12 traditions today. Because you see, in the last little while, 1950, Dr. Bob, shortly after the Toronto Conference in 1955, Dr. Harry Thibault, Miami Conference, my beloved Bernie left, and now Bill. We need more than ever to look at and talk about and love the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. Decided that there had to be a way to perpetuate this society of ours so that there would be no power struggle after they were gone. And they set about to work out the third legacy, our legacy of service. And this, again, was something that caused all kinds of consternation amongst the drunks. They knew that we didn't need this, you know. This was something that they opposed very, very strenuously. And there was a big fight over the third legacy, the legacy of service. In writing this thing up, Bernie Smith, who was an international lawyer and a most wonderful man, probably had the greatest feel for Alcoholics Anonymous of any non-alcoholic that ever lived. If he was non-alcoholic. I used to tell him all the time that he was on the wrong side of the table. But it may be just because I loved him so much. But he certainly had the feel of this society of ours, and he was of infinite value in working out the 12 concepts of our third legacy of service. And again, that was quite a rough time, and it, as has been said, was accepted in 1955. We started in 1951 on a five-year trial basis. And in 1955, Bill and the board and the rest of the old-timers gave the society to us with a way to perpetuate itself from now on by our delegates and our General Service Conference in New York. It worked out beautifully in the five-year period of trial and error, and it's worked out beautifully ever since. But again, it's not something that can last forever unless you and I know it and work it and love it. And the next thing that came about was the change in the ratio of the trustees. And this was very, very close to Bill's heart. And this maybe caused the greatest struggle in all AA history. There were some who got drunk and a few who died over this struggle. Just the change of the ratio. You'll all remember, those of you who've been around a little while, that in the beginning we had 8 non-alcoholic trustees and 7 alcoholic trustees. And when we first started, we all thought that was necessary, or they thought it was necessary before I got here. Because nobody knew how long anybody was going to stay sober, you know. And they thought we better have built in a little reserve, yeah. And so they set it up, 8 non-alcoholics and 7 alcoholics. And of course, over the years, Bill became more and more convinced that this should be changed. After all, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous should at least own their own society. We should have the privilege of either building it or wrecking it. And so the struggle went forward to change the ratio of the trustees. And of course that came about very beautifully and was settled some time back. So that made all the things that Bill had set about for himself to do. He had gotten finished before he had to leave, before his illness. Now, I want to talk a little bit about my own great privilege of knowing, for instance, not only Bill, but Mr. C and I knew Bill and Lois very, very personally. They in our house and we in theirs. We also had the privilege of meeting Dr. Bob and Ann. We also knew Ebby quite well and had the privilege of spending quite a little time with him. Bertie, of course, I knew intimately when I was your delegate and loved him very, very much. Sister Ignatia, I had known not too well. Dr. Tebow, I knew. I did not know Dr. Silkworth. But all these folks I had the privilege of knowing. And particularly Bill. And just for a few minutes, I want to tell you the highlights. The things that I remember the most. As most of you know, I was second delegate from this area to New York. Cliffy W. was first. And so I went back in 1953, and I served as the delegate in 53 and 54. And after the 54 conference, Bill came to me and he says, Chuck, you've been back here 2 years in a row, and you've never taken 5 seconds of my time. And he says, I think I know why. And it's high time that you and I were to get better acquainted. And says he, I'm going to come out and see you. Well, you're going to knock me down with a feather. How come this head man, the guy that I had on a pedestal about 90 feet high, was going to come out and see me? And so when I could talk, I said, well, we got a bed for you. We'd be glad to see you anytime. And it wasn't too long until he came. And he spent 3 days in our house in Beverly Hills. And we never opened the front door. We just talked all the time. Well, now, one of the great impressions that I have of Bill, he didn't bring a bathrobe with him. And as you guys know, he was about 8 feet tall and very thin, and so he borrowed a bathrobe, and it hit him about, just above the knees. He had a mini bathrobe. And he ran around the house there in that bathrobe, you know. And he was the funniest looking guy you ever saw. And so I remember this very well. I also remember that he brought a problem of his own to me. I think that was an excuse. But he brought a problem anyway, and so that made him my baby. And you know something? In the next 5 years, I like to kill him. He was my baby, and he wasn't happy. And by gad, I was going to make a joyous man out of him, whether he liked it or not. I figured this way, and I thought it was good figured. I was a neophyte, and I was happy as a bird dog, you know. And here the founder wasn't too happy. He was subject to depressions. And so I was going to make a happy man out of it.
And I worked on
him for the next 5 years. And finally, I got wise. And so I quit thinking that he had to be made happy, that I had to make him joyous. But I had to go back and see him. And so Mrs. C and I arrived back here at LaGuardia Field in New York one very early morning. And Bill came to meet us. And he had an overcoat. It was just the length of that bathrobe. And he was late. And he finally got down there. He was limping, too. And he finally got there and picked us up, and we started to Bedford Hills. And you know something? His car conked out right on the ramp getting on the freeway. Well, Bill was telling us at that time about the concepts. You know, they hadn't been written yet. But he had them all in his head. And when he picked us up, he started talking, and he never quit. And the car conked out on the ramp, and we just sat there. He never missed a period or a comma. And finally, somebody came by on the freeway, mind you. Just one of the New Yorkers. I think there are 9 million of them or something. I don't know how many. And he stopped and he says, "You're in trouble." And Bill says, "No, it'll start directly." And the old boy says, "Well, I'm going to be gone about 15 minutes, but I'm coming back. And if you're still here, I'll stop again." And 15, 20 minutes, he came back by, and we're still sitting there. And he came up, and he says, "I think you're in trouble." Bill says, "It'll start." Every once in a while, he'd put his finger on the button to start it, but it wouldn't start. And so the old boy talked him into letting him take the fuel pump, which he did. Now, all the time, we're sitting on the ramp, see? And he's talking, never missing a word. And the guy brought the fuel pump back and put it on, and it would start, but it wouldn't run good. So he says, "I'm going to have to take this to the shop." And so he got in and drove the car up on the hill and took us someplace for breakfast. See, we were heading to his house for breakfast, and it's almost lunchtime already. And we went in and sat down to eat, and I says, "Bill, how many people in New York?" And he told me. And I says, "Well, you never saw this guy hardly before, did you?" And he says, "No, I never did." Well, I says, "I don't mind you giving him your car, but you gave him our luggage." Bill says he'll be back. And so help me, by the time we got through breakfast, he was back. And the car ran, so we went to Bedford Hills. Now, what I had gone back there for was to tell him this. "Bill, you don't have to get happy if you don't want to." "You have my permission to do anything that you like. You can get drunk, you can shoot dope, you can rape, you can murder, you can do anything. But you can't keep me from loving you." And I got that off my back, and he never bothered me anymore. And the funny part of it was, it wasn't too long until I was getting letters with words in them like joy. You know? He got joyous in spite of me. The next thing I would call to your attention was that I sat up there in that little shack on the hill at Bedford Hills. Beautiful spot back there. And he just had the headings for the 12 concepts. We sat up there in that shack for a whole day while he finished explaining the 12 concepts. Now, one of the things that we're so fortunate in is that Bill lived one day at a time. But he had the beautiful ability to look 25, 50 years in the future. And the things that were necessary for us, he worked out while he was here, like the traditions and the 12 concepts and the change in the ratio of the trustees and the whole business. It was all done while he was around. The ability to look long into the future and see the pitfalls that would come up and to make it impossible for these things to happen. Now, today I want to just say a few more words and stop. Again, I think that this is a very, very important time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not one to point with pride or view with alarm. But there are many, many things, straws in the wind, that we must all be totally aware of and be willing to attempt to steer each other rightly when these things come about. For instance, there is much talk amongst our younger people in Alcoholics Anonymous that we've got to change our format. That we've got to open the doors to Alcoholics Anonymous. That we need confrontation groups, and we need sensitivity groups, and we need to allow those who don't have an alcoholic problem, the users of dope who are not alcoholics, to be a part of our society. There are those who are yakking big and doing this also, starting what they call family groups in Alcoholics Anonymous. Family groups in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a family group thing. It is not for all the troubled peoples of the world. We are in one business, and one business only. Our business is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And that's the only business we're in. And it's the business we must stay in if we're going to survive. It is not that we think that we're better than or worse than or different from many of the peoples who have other problems. It's simply this, that we started with people who had all the problems. In the Oxford movement, every problem was represented that there is. Dope, sex, liquor, money, everything you can think of was represented in those who went to the Oxford movement for help. And we didn't leave them because we didn't like them. We left them because there wasn't time to work with our own people. We wanted to use a rifle instead of a shotgun. And so we had to limit our scope to the alcoholic, so that we could be of maximum use one to another. And so it's very necessary that we remember this. Now, anybody who has an alcoholic problem, who has any number of other tie-ups, is welcome not only in our closed meetings as a member and a participant, but also in our open meetings as a member and a participant. Others who don't have an alcoholic problem but have many related problems are welcome in our open meetings, but not as participants.
And again, it's not because we don't love them, and it's not because we don't think our program works in their instance. It's simply because we haven't that much time. We are the husbands of our time, and we must walk the line. In the next few years, very few years, we're going to be confronted more than ever by the other agencies trying to get us to affiliate with them. Right now, there's much being said about getting up to the pig trough. You know, we've got a bill through Congress not long ago that carries with it about $500 million. It's going to be administered by Health, Education, and Welfare. And so they tell us now, if you want to get some of this dough, you got to line up with us. Alcoholism and related problems. And we're going to have a lot of pressure on us in the next few years. And there's going to be a lot of jobs that many of our people might think were pretty nice. And there'll be jobs that our people can take. I'm not one who says that our people are not supposed to work in industry or in other facilities. But as a society, we cannot affiliate with any of them. We must stay in the business that we're in and doing so well in. Now, the next thing. I even hear, and it shatters me a little bit, people who seemingly should know better say, well, if this is against the traditions, we'll change the traditions. They're old now anyway. We got them in 1950, you know. Well, just for the information of all of us, the General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous and the General Service Board are the custodians of the traditions and our 12 steps of recovery. But they cannot change the traditions or our 12 steps of recovery. The only way our recovery program and our traditions can ever be changed is by the entire membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think they're in pretty good hands, because I think we're going to stay with it. Now, lastly, I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous more than I love my own life. I love the people in it. I love that head man of ours like nobody's business. He was a fantastic man. Our society, of course, was built on a transcendent spiritual experience. Your sobriety and mine is possible by the grace of God, and only by the grace of God. And when I hear the talk about changing our program, about updating it, I have to say to myself, since when have we developed a society that can update God? And so it is that I take this particular occasion as a personal rededication to our program of recovery, to our tradition, and to our legacy of service. And may I always walk in the footsteps of those who went before me. God bless you. Thank you very much.